The phone rang. She looked at the incoming number. Base call. Could it be the guy from Dad's funeral? Could he actually be pressing her this hard on this day? She didn't believe it. Hello? Lieutenant? Look, mister, are you somewhere in the chain of command? Because if you aren't, very frankly, I am here trying to deal with the death of my father and really my only friend, and I am just not doing this. There was a silence. It extended. I am in the chain of command, he said at last. My orders are legal. Could this be real? Could this guy really actually be on the phone pushing her around like this now? I'd like to do this tomorrow. You have your orders, Lieutenant. She hung up the phone and wanted very badly to do something hurtful to this man. But that was military life, wasn't it? You weren't here to grieve. She reported to an impressive but sterile office suite that had all the anonymous earmarks of being some kind of official visitor's lair. She was called in immediately. With Mr. Crewe was the younger of the two colonels, Langford. She was just as glad. The older one had exuded something that made her uneasy. Wilkes, or whatever his name was. The office was large and the furniture real wood, but there wasn't a single citation on the walls, nor a photograph, nor anything that might identify him further. Obviously a spook, but not Air Force, or he'd be in uniform. She saluted the colonel. He returned. At ease, Lieutenant, he said, smiling and shaking his head slightly. Please take a seat, Crewe said. I want to extend my sympathies, too, Langford added. Your father was a great man and a national hero. You should know that he's going to receive the Intelligence Medal. He paused. And also the Medal of Honor. She knew that her mouth had dropped open because she had to snap it closed. The Congressional Medal of Honor. Crewe nodded. She was stunned silent. In awe. In sorrow that he had not been able to share what terrors must have beset him in his work and had killed him. Do you remember the tests you took at Lackland? What in the world did that have to do with anything? I took a lot of tests during basic. One of them involved a page of numbers and you were supposed to draw lines between them. Sure. I remember it, she said. The test had been tucked in among the standard battery of aptitude tests she'd taken as a recruit. Sort of connect-the-dots type thing. She'd sort of doodled it, as she recalled. I messed it up. The two men stared at her, saying nothing. They looked, she thought, like people must look to an ape from inside his cage. What on earth does it matter now? I have another test for you, he said. Another test? That's what this is about? Because, Lieutenant, it's terribly important. Langford's voice had an edge that told her to listen and keep her mouth shut. You need to fill out a consent. I thought you were going to let me know something about my dad. I am. She took the form he handed her and was very surprised as she read it, to see that it was no ordinary medical consent. She looked at Langford. His face was bland. A dentist's face, that is to say, a mask. She read aloud. Any commentary or discussion or unauthorized record of any subject or meeting or action carried out within the context of the project is prohibited conduct and subject to prosecution under provisions of the National Security Act of 1947 as amended. She tried to laugh. They remained silent. This is very heavy stuff. Still nothing. Excuse me, but this is a very serious document here. She pushed the paper back toward Crewe's side of the desk. We can't bargain with you, Langford said. And we can't talk until you sign. Volunteer or be shot, in other words. Langford pushed the paper back toward her. Don't miss this, he said. You're first in line, Lieutenant Glass. But there is a line. If I sign and don't like what I hear, can I walk away? Langford turned toward Crewe, who didn't so much as blink. I'm sorry, but the agreement is binding, Langford said. It commits me to something I can't learn about until I'm in it, and then I can't get out. I know it sounds unreasonable. Unreasonable? It's downright scary. More than scary, I mean the Air Force doesn't handle things this way. She wondered if that was actually true. Sign it. It would be very helpful. Maybe her dad was looking down on her right now, probably was, assuming there was anything left of him, any sort of a soul. She picked up a pen off the desk and had the odd feeling that these two guys were waiting, but in a funny way, like they were hungry almost. And she was lunch. So, I don't think I need to do this, she said. No. And she was more than a little ashamed. Sorry, Dad, but this does not feel right. Crewe unfolded his long legs and leaned forward. She expected him to speak, but he did not speak. He just looked at her. It wasn't a special expression, not at all. But it moved her. It did, definitely. A very serious, very important moment. I can't very well jump off a cliff without knowing what's at the bottom, can I? Crewe sighed. Was it anger? Suppressed impatience? Boy, she could not read this guy. You thought saint, then you thought, well, something else. We want you to continue your father's work, Crewe said. If you pass this small test. It's urgent, Langford added. You'll need to start this afternoon. Crewe pushed the agreement back at her. But what did he do? Please help us, Crewe said. His voice was still as soft as ever, but the desperation in it was somehow terrifying. What if I can't? He smiled then, very slightly. Suddenly, she knew that she would not walk away from this. She could not live the rest of her life in ignorance of what her dad had done, knowing that she had passed up this chance. He had been killed, though. She grabbed the paper, signed, then thrust it back. Colonel Langford took it, folded it once, and slipped it into a manila envelope. You'll get a copy countersigned by the Secretary of Defense, he said. You're kidding. Lauren, you have a very unique ability, the big man said. Inherited, we believe. That first test you took, you passed. You were the only person to have done so in the 40 years it has been administered in one form or another to every military recruit in the United States, Canada, Great Britain, New Zealand, and Australia. The only one who even came close. But we weren't surprised, given who your father is. That sort of sounded... Whoa. Did you say... What's that? You are one in many millions, Lauren. You have inherited an absolutely unique skill from your dad. What in the world could this be? I have to tell you honestly, I have no unusual skills. I want to warn you, you're going to have a very extraordinary experience. I want you to understand that it will not be in any way pleasant or easy. I won't pretend that there's no danger, because it must be obvious to you that there is great danger. What's more, we're not going to be able to help you. You have to do it on your own. And you are on your own. But, you said there was a list, Colonel Langford, and you were going to the next person if I didn't sign. I lied. And you will too, many times. It will be a big part of your job. If I'd said no, despite Dad, absolutely and finally no, what then? Crewe said, we would have had to say something dramatic like the survival of the human race might depend on you. The words hung in the air. Unbelievable, crazy even. She didn't know whether she should be scared or what. Finally, the whole idea just seemed so overblown that she burst out laughing. And it was the only sound in the room, and it stayed the only sound in the room. She looked from one deadly serious face to the other. They actually were not in any way kidding. But she was a girl. She was 22. And while she liked being both things, neither suggested that she had any sort of amazing mission in life. This is too weird, she said slowly. I mean, are you telling me I'm some kind of outrageous, like, freak? Langford cleared his throat. You know nothing about your father's work. She shook her head. You're what we call an empath. You can hear thought, and you can transmit it to others who can hear it. Yeah, Dad used to say that. He read science fiction too, Arthur C. Clarke kind of thing. Crew handed her a yellow pad. Write down the first thing that comes to mind. She took the pad, thought for a moment, then scrawled the first word that came to mind. The name of my dad's barber, she said. Adam. Now Langford pulled an envelope out of his pocket. The person you will be working with cannot speak. His brain is so entirely different that without a person like you, we can only exchange the most rudimentary ideas. At present he is terribly upset, but we have succeeded in getting him to transmit the name we call him to you. He handed her the envelope. In it was a note, scrawled on a piece of paper that smelled oddly of what she thought might be Lysol. The single word written there was, Adam. She looked at it. She looked back up at the two men. Who is this guy anyway? That's part of what we've been trying to understand, Lieutenant Glass. What your father spent his career working on. His name is Adam, but you don't understand... What? They don't have a naming convention in their culture. Adam and Bob are really just our labels. Bob? Died. Another death. She noted that. But who in the world would communicate via thought and not use names? Our next step will be to send you to meet the head of your part of the project. He operates a very small unit and runs a very, very tight ship, Colonel Langford said. You have to understand you are never to speak to him about your background, about your meeting with us, about anything that you do not absolutely need to talk to him about in order to do your work. Do you understand that? This was sounding crazier and crazier. So I just walk up to the guy, my commanding officer, and I say, what? The colonel handed her an envelope. You don't say anything. You give him this. He'll take it from there. She recognized the envelope, of course. It carried orders. She started to open it. No. No? I don't open my own orders? She shook her head. Why am I not surprised? He gave her a card with an address in Indianapolis on it. You'll drive to your new assignment. Colonel Michael Wilkes will be expecting you. You saw Mike at the funeral. You will receive further orders from him verbally. He paused for a moment. Lauren, he continued, I want you to understand that there's an extremely good reason for all this secrecy. In time, you'll come to know this reason, and you will find yourself in the same position we are. It's a secret that you won't hesitate to defend with your life. She found herself walking toward the parking lot with this weird verbal order to report to an address in University Heights in Indianapolis, and to be there by 6 this evening. Not impossible that it was a little over 100 miles, and she had 5 hours. Typical of the Air Force, though, she'd been sitting in procurement for 2 years, and then, with barely time to go back to the apartment and grab her toothbrush, she was on the move to, of all places, Indianapolis, and not even a U.S. Air Force facility as far as she could tell. You just get your belongings out of your billet and go, Langford had said. No goodbyes, no emails, no cell calls. She had friends, a life, at least something of a life. No, hell, there was Molly at the office who was going to wonder. There was Charlie Fellows, who was getting to be more than just a friend, but he was out on a refueling mission and wouldn't be back for 48 hours. So he was just going to find her apartment empty, her cell phone disconnected, and her email bouncing everything back. She worried that she'd run into a familiar face on her way home, but all was quiet. She knew the Air Force. Her current commanding officer, General Winters, would have been duly informed of her transfer, etc. But nothing would run smoothly. Undoubtedly, the next thing she'd get from her current unit would be a notice that she was AWOL. She spent 3/4 of an hour packing. At the last, she put their small photo album in a suitcase. Her and Dad through the years. She staggered down to the parking lot under her bags and got the Focus pretty much stuffed to the roof liner. Then she was gone. Out of here, no looking back. It was not until she was sailing west on 70 and WTUE was rocking into her past that she began to think again about Dad's dreams. As a little girl, she'd covered her head with her pillow and begged God to help him. Later, she'd gone into his bedroom to try to provide him with whatever support a daughter could. She would find him with his eyes wide open, screaming and shaking his head from side to side, and you could not wake him up. He'd said, It was Nam coming back to haunt him. He'd flown Huey's in Nam, and he had two hearts for his trouble, also a scar down his back where he'd been wounded. His story was that a lot of guys had burned alive in a hospital tent that had been torched by the VC, helpless guys, guys with no faces, guys with no legs. He'd had a broken arm and a bad infection. But he could run, at least. There was, of course, a problem with this. It was that, as she knew, her father had not served in Vietnam. She'd seen his duty book, and he just had never served there. In fact, her father had served at White Sands, then at an army base in Arizona called Fort Huachuca. Her earliest memories were of the wonderful rocks around Fort Huachuca. After that, they'd come to Wright Pat, where he'd been connected with the Air Materiel Command. She knew that because his unit was attached to the Behavioral Research Directorate, which was a division of AMC. She knew that behavioral research was about understanding things like pilot alertness and endurance, also muddier stuff, non-lethal weapons and such. It was a nice drive once you got out of Dayton traffic, which was, truth to be told, pretty minor. Farms, midsummer corn, a different way of life out here. She'd liked to run tractors and combines and things. She liked big machines. She'd been around the Midwest for a while now, so Indy was no stranger to her. Back before Mom moved home to Glasgow, they'd gone to the 500 here practically every year. Mom was into fast cars, or rather, the drivers, the mechanics, and just about anybody connected with racing. Actually, just about anybody else at all, as long as it wasn't Dad. She was expecting an office building at least, or maybe some kind of lab facility tucked away next to the university. But this was pure residential around here, wide streets, big old houses, quiet in the late afternoon. She drove past 101 Hamilton and was, frankly, confused. It was a house. Looked like it had been built around 1910 in the craftsman style. Beautiful place for sure, but a house. An Air Force facility was in a house in a neighborhood. Okay, so be it. She pulled into the driveway behind a very sweet-looking SLK convertible that was, no, not your usual Air Force colonel's automobile. It was possible, of course, that the car belonged to somebody else, but she'd been told that the chilly Colonel Wilkes ran the place, and this car was in a special little chunk of tarmac all its own. Commanding officer's privilege, for sure. She knew her Air Force. There was only one other vehicle there, though, and the garage was padlocked. The other car was an Acura, not too young. So there was Colonel Wilkes with a fast car and a flunky to be named later. Not the lowest of the low. They'd be in your Focus or your Echo like her, trying to make ends meet on just enough money to make that impossible. As she mounted the stairs to the porch, she noticed, of all things, a pair of longhorns over the front door. She stood looking at this incredibly improbable choice of decoration for Indianapolis, Indiana. The front door had one of those old-fashioned bells on it that she twisted. She turned it and was rewarded by a dry crunching sound, not loud, in fact hardly audible. So she did it again, a couple of times. She was still doing it when the door swept open, and Colonel Wilkes, looking shockingly older than this morning, stood there staring at her out of bloodshot eyes. "Please come in," he said, stepping aside. His voice sounded sad, and she had the odd impression that he might have actually been crying. She noticed that there were boxes against the wall. "They're yours," Wilkes said. "Amon's things."
"Colonel, nobody has told me yet what happened to my dad. I've been ordered to come to this place, and I have no idea why, beyond reasons that sound like some sort of science fiction crap to me. And I have to tell you that this is not being done right. Couldn't someone have at least warned me that I'd come here and see Dad's stuff in damn boxes?"
"Who sent you here?"
She could not believe that he actually didn't know. "I've been ordered not to tell you." He nodded, as if that was the most natural thing in the world. She followed him into an office that had clearly been carved out of what was once the master bedroom.
"This place was built in 1908 by Indy's only cattle baron," he said as he dropped down behind his desk. There had been no exchange of salutes, but he was her superior officer, so she brought her hand to her forehead and said, "Lieutenant Lauren Glass reporting as ordered, sir." He looked up at her, Obviously. Please go to the scrub room and get prepped.
Excuse me?
The scrub room. You'll find it at the base of the shaft.
Sir, I have to explain to you I have no idea what's going on here. I would like a little more information, sir.
You'll get the hang of it.
Look, what is this scrub room? What do I have to scrub for?
Listen, I know you don't understand any of this. We were planning to bring you along as your dad reached retirement. Nobody thought it would be like this. But we have a desperate situation, Lauren.
She found a chair. Sir, I'm sorry to disabuse you, but I have not been on any training program in any way, shape, or form. I am not prepared for whatever this is. I basically have no idea what you're doing here at all, but whatever it is, it killed. She had to stop. Her grief, appearing suddenly, had choked her on her own words.
Lauren, I knew your dad for a long time, so you'll know that what I'm about to say is not meant to be hard or callous. It is what your dad would say to you if he could talk right now. Your dad would say to you, soldier, you have a duty. Do your duty.
Sir, respectfully, you tell me in one breath that my predecessor is a KIA, then you tell me to proceed into whatever situation he was in with no training or prep whatsoever. Sir, I would like to understand this order a little better. I know that I am dealing with somebody called Adam, and my father dealt with him, and with somebody called Bob, and my father died as a result. That is the extent of my knowledge. He stood up so suddenly that she did too. He turned his back on her and strode to the window.
There is no training, and there is no time. I want you down there now because we have a situation, Lieutenant, and I believe, I know that you are the only person remotely available to us who might be able to help.
When he attempted to smile at her, she saw that coldness again, this time more clearly than she had at the grave. This was a driven man, she thought, a fanatic, and she wondered, should she trust the fanatic? Well, Dad had. This was his commanding officer, this frosty man with his carefully decorated office and his fabulous car. He showed her to a small elevator that opened under the front stairs.
There's a very skilled man at the other end who will be there to help you.
She stepped into the dim interior and descended. It felt as if it was moving fast and continued for more than a minute. When the doors opened, she found a chunky young man in a white sterile suit waiting for her, and saw that he had been the fourth man at the funeral.
I'm Andy Morgan, he said. Welcome to the facility.
This place is deep.
We're 280 feet down, deep in the bedrock.
He tapped a foot on the floor.
Basalt.
Faintly, she could hear another voice. It was groaning and sounded tired, also angry. She looked around, but saw nobody. Who is that?
Andy Morgan shook his head. You're good, he said.
Who's moaning? What's going on in here?
Lauren, listen to me. You're going to meet him in a moment. Sort of meet him. What you're hearing is coming through a 6-foot-thick tempered steel wall that is further protected by a high-intensity electromagnetic field.
Then how can we possibly be hearing it? Because it's perfectly clear, and the man is in agony.
I can't hear it.
But that's crazy. Listen to him. He's wailing.
The fact that you can hear his thoughts is why you're here.
What thoughts? He's crying.
You need to go in there, Andy Morgan said.
The same tone she thought that he might have used if he had told her it was time for her to do her wing walk, or perhaps go over Niagara Falls in a barrel. Behind him was a steel door, armored and locked with great gleaming bolts. Why in the world would anybody be that locked up? What did they have in there, some kind of deranged Superman? She tried to conceal her total and complete mystification, not to say her fear, and to concentrate on what she needed to know here on a practical basis. Now is this person going to be violent?
Baby, he is flying in there. He's been bouncing off the walls ever since the colonel bought it.
Excuse me, since your dad passed away. Before I go in there, I think you'd better tell me exactly what happened to him. He lowered his head.
Nobody told you?
They did not.
Okay. Your dad got a scratch.
A scratch?
That caused an allergic reaction so intense that he bled out.
She did not need to think very long about that. She sat down in one of the two chairs that stood before the control panel. I'm not doing this. He was a gentle-looking guy, more than a little overweight, with sad, sad eyes.
They sent you all the way down here without telling you a damn thing, didn't they?
That would be correct.
Okay. I'm going to level with you. Have you ever heard of aliens?
Yeah.
No green card.
The other kind?
Oh, that stuff? I have no interest in that stuff.
Perhaps you had better see your dad's office.
God, I'd love that.
Across the small room was a door. The nameplate holder was empty. He unlocked the door and she saw a small windowless space that had a steel desk, a couple of chairs, and a cot. There was a bookcase also, and it was filled with books on electromagnetism and, of all things, UFOs. She read the titles, Intruders, Communion, UFO Condition Red, UFOs in the National Security State, and dozens more.
You can pick what you'd like to keep, we'll ditch the others.
He lifted a picture that was lying face down on the desk.
I knew you'd want this.
It filled her heart and her eyes. The picture of the two of them taken when she was 12. They were at Cape May, New Jersey. She was wearing a new bathing suit, and her Boston Terrier, Prissy, was still alive. For a moment she smelled the salt in the air, remembered a radio playing down the beach, and heard the breeze fluttering in their cabana. He took the picture and set it on the desk.
This is your office now.
There's an alien down here?
And your father was his empath. And you will be his empath.
Meaning?
You are going to find that you can see pictures he makes in his mind and describe what you see to us.
Her father had kept quite a secret.
I should have been trained. Your dad wanted to wait until you'd had a little more Air Force. You know, you sign up and you wear a uniform. But really becoming part of this crazy organization takes time. Your dad wanted you to have that time.
I'm an Air Force brat down to my toes.
He knew that. He respected that. But duty is something different. I mean, our kind of duty. Keeping a secret so big that it is a kind of agony. Above all, knowing every time you go in that room over there that you might die, every time. But doing it like your dad did on behalf of the Air Force, the country, and future of man. He took the picture from her, looked at it.
We need you to get in there and calm Adam down. If we can't get him to pull himself together, he's going to literally be busted apart by knocking into those walls in there. Considering that he's been doing this since your dad passed.
We're desperate, Lieutenant.
Either she took up her dad's sword or she let it lie, and let the meaning of his life lie with him in his grave.
There was no real choice here, never had been.
She took a deep breath.
Okay, what do I do?
He drew her through a steel door into a tiny dressing area. She stood naked in a shower with nozzles on the ceiling and walls, turning slowly as instructed with her hands raised over her head, while green chemical stinking liquid sluiced over her. Still wet, she donned an orange isolation suit and what felt like asphalt gloves, they were so thick.
He's electromagnetically active,
Andy explained. If you touch him, he'll extend into your nervous system and take over your body. You don't want that.
No.
Cover your face with Vaseline. Here's an epinephrine injector. If you get the least feeling of even so much as a tickle in your throat, press it against your leg and get out of there. As she dug into the Vaseline container, she reflected that her father's hand was probably the last to do this. She could almost feel him beside her right now, telling her not to be scared, to remember her duty, that he was with her every step of the way. Then something changed. The room, the guy, everything around her disappeared. She was suddenly and vividly in another room. It had stainless steel walls, a black floor, and a fluorescent ceiling. There was a man on a table, naked, surrounded by people in full protective gear, sterile suits, faceplates down, the works. The man was purple. His chest was heaving and blood was oozing out of his eyes, out of his nose, down his cheeks like tears. The hallucination, or whatever it was so vivid that she might as well have actually been standing in the place. She could even hear the air conditioning hissing and the muffled voices of the doctors behind the masks who were trying to save the man on the table. He gasped again as they set up an IV. A nurse intoned,
BP 280 over 200, heart rate 160, basal BP rising, glucose 320 rising, we have another infarction. There was a high-pitched whine and blood began spraying out of his skin, spraying their face masks and their white sterile suits, beading and running down to the floor as he bled from every pore, a haze of blood, pink and fine, like it was being sprayed from 1,000 tiny high-pressure nozzles affixed to his body. Then his head turned and she saw his face, and an ice-cold spike stabbed her straight in the heart. In that instant, the vision of her dad's death ended. She realized that she was still in the basement room she had entered in the first place, and Andy was supporting her under her arms. "Sorry," she managed to mutter, regaining her footing and stepping away from him. I think it's the depth."
"If you say so."
He put an arm around her. "Back off. Hey, okay, I'm just trying to help here."
She blew out breath, then shook her head. That had been vivid. That had been real vivid.
Andy watched her.
"You sure you're okay?"
"I'm not okay, no."
"Oh, was that a seizure? Because
it's my business, okay?"
"Okay, sorry."
He paused then, and when she said nothing more, continued.
"I'm going to open up the cage itself. When you enter, you'll see a chair and a table. Sit in the chair."
"That's it? That's all I get to know?"
"It's all any of us know. Frankly, what your dad did, and what we know you can do, is not understood. You just have to do it."
"And what if I can't?"
"You've passed the test."
He went to a small keyboard and keyed in a combination. "I'll be in the control room. You'll be able to see and hear me and vice versa. If you get into trouble, I'll pull you out. But obviously things can happen fast in there."
He left the dressing room, closing the heavy outer door behind him. A moment later, his voice returned, tinny, coming out of a ceiling speaker. "You reading me?"
"Yeah."
"Okay. The door's opening now."
There was a loud click, then a whirring sound, and the wall of the little chamber slid back. She saw before her a room lit by what appeared to be ultraviolet light. It reminded her of the animals of the night exhibit at the Cleveland Zoo, where the vampire bats and things were deceived into thinking it was dark during the day.
"Are there any lights?"
"Don't worry about seeing him, you won't.
If you get so much as a glimpse, count yourself lucky. Pay attention to the corners of your eyes."
"The corners of my eyes? You mean use my peripheral vision?" Then the air hit her. It was dry, real dry. She could feel her face shriveling. It was so dry, feel her lips starting to crack. The function of the Vaseline was now clear, and she grabbed another handful of it right in the glove and slathered it on. The room open before her was not large, maybe 20 by 20. It looked like it had rubber walls. There was a window on the far side, and Andy could be seen sitting there at a control panel. His face glowed green from the instruments before him. Suddenly something shot past so fast, she lurched back, waving her hands. It felt like nothing so much as being buzzed by a fly, but not a small fly, no. More like the size, say, of a buzzard. There was also a voice, groaning, howling, wailing, and it was the strangest voice she had ever heard, because of the way it echoed in her ears and her mind at the same time, as if she was hearing both sounds and thoughts that were the same as the sounds.
A thud, bzzd, thud, bzzd, thud, bzzd,
shot around the room, and with it the wailing, mourning voice, its howl thin and pitiful now. She saw something, a flash of something that gleamed black. It was big, the size of a hand, and slanted. It was also brilliantly alive, a big gleaming eye. A sound came out of her that she knew objectively was a scream, sharp, intense, made of pure fear. The wailing at once increased. Now it was desolated, like he'd been instantly aware of her revulsion and her fright, and it was making him feel really, really miserable. "Hold on," she said, dimly. She was conscious that Wilkes was now standing beside the tech at the control panel. Suddenly the buzzing stopped.